Good morning. This is Daniel Cobb, doctor of oriental medicine, and welcome to my radio show, Natural Medicine. I've been a DOM for about 10 years. I've published articles in various journals, such as Wellbeing Journal, the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine. I've got articles published on the Foundation for Alternative and Integrative Medicine. And for about the past 4 years, I've been teaching anatomy and physiology at various professional schools around Santa Fe and Albuquerque. And I do want to give out the call-in number, 505-424-4550. And I really do want to point out that we love call-in questions, especially today. Because today I have as my guest Neil Miller. And I cleared with him that I can actually say that I think that Neil is probably one of the three or four most knowledgeable people about vaccines in the entire country. He happens to live in Santa Fe, much to my good fortune, and agreed to be on my show today. So, Neil, why don't you give us a little background and tell us how you got interested in vaccines, and tell us about your, then tell us about your website, Think Twice.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity to share the information that I have with our listening audience. I've been researching vaccines for more than 25 years now. I began researching vaccines when my own children were born many years ago. My wife and I felt that we had this obligation to investigate vaccines and to find out whether they truly are safe and effective and appropriate for our children. My research took me to medical journals, scientific studies, and everything that I could find. I wanted to really uncover what was real from what was not real. And I began to gather studies that showed scientific evidence that vaccines were not always safe and not always effective. As I gathered this evidence, it became clear to both my wife and I that we were not going to vaccinate our children. And we never looked back from that point on. The evidence that I continued to gather started to snowball. People began to come to me asking for some of the information, for me to share that information on what I discovered. And that became my first book. My first book then became my second book. And now I've written several books on vaccines that document the safety and efficacy issues associated with vaccines. For example, my latest book, Vaccine Safety Manual for Concerned Families and Health Practitioners, is nearly 400 pages. It's got more than 60 pages of scientific references, scientific citations, so that everything that is stated inside that book will provide you. You can go and look that information up from the direct sources themselves. As far as my website, you can go up to thinktwice.com, and there's lots of free information up there. You can find out, you read about some of these studies. You can find support groups in any part of the country. You can find out if vaccines are legally required to enter school here in New Mexico. The answer is no. You can sign an exemption form. Perhaps we can talk a little bit more about that later. But that's the short version of who I am and what it is that I do.
And has this become a full-time job for you?
Well, you know, I do several other things. I've got a lot of interests, but yes, definitely I go all over the country and speak. For example, in a couple of weeks I'll be out in Orlando, Florida, speaking to a large group of chiropractors. I was in Canada earlier this year, up in near Toronto, speaking to a group actually of natural farmers, holistic farmers. They had me up there. They wanted me to speak and to educate them, not just about vaccines for animals, which I'm not that familiar with, not as familiar with the vaccines for animals as I am with human vaccines, but they invited me up there to speak about the problems with human vaccines. So I do a lot of speaking, I do a lot of lectures, I do a lot of radio interviews, but most of all, I'm very concerned about allowing parents to have access to all of the available information. I don't tell parents what they should or should not do with regard to vaccines. I don't feel that that's my responsibility, but I do feel very strongly about parents having access to all of the available information so that they can make freely informed decisions about whether or not to vaccinate their family members.
And Neil, now, when you get into vaccines, you know, sometimes vaccines are presented as here's something that's really wonderful. It'll prevent you from getting this disease. It'll expose you in a minor way to this this disease where you won't really get the disease. But sometimes there's a lot of things in that vaccine besides what they're telling you about. And sometimes those may be dangerous.
Yes, that's a big problem right now, is what's actually inside those vaccines. But that's only one of the problems, and I will talk about some of those ingredients because I've got numerous studies documenting the health hazards of many of the ingredients that are placed into vaccines. But another major problem is that they're giving too many vaccines to these children all at one time. And in fact, I've written a couple of studies that were published in peer-reviewed journals that document the health hazards of giving too many vaccines simultaneously. For example, right now, most children throughout the nation are required to get eight vaccines at 2 months of age, eight vaccines at 4 months of age, and nine vaccines at 6 months of age. And this is what this is causing is what could be labeled as toxic synergy. The synergistic effects of giving too many drugs at one time. I often ask parents, when is the last time that you took eight drugs at the same time? And they look at me flabbergasted. And I said, even in your worst college days, did you ever take eight drugs at one time? And I asked them, I said, would you be more surprised if you did take eight drugs at one time? Would you be more surprised if you did or did not have a serious adverse reaction? And because that's what we're giving little 2-month-old infants, and eight vaccines at one time. But one of the ingredients that I want to talk about today is aluminum, okay? Because, you know, there was a lot of problems with the mercury that was placed in vaccines, and some vaccines still contain mercury. It was taken out of some vaccines, but some vaccines still do contain high concentrations of mercury.
Now, Neil, just, you know, for the benefit of the listeners, if they go to their vaccine insert and they look for the mercury in there and they say, oh, there's no mercury, maybe they're looking for the wrong thing.
Well, mercury is actually labeled as thimerosal, T-H-I-M-E-R-O-S-A-L. Thimerosal is the trade name, and it's 50% mercury by weight. Right now, the flu vaccine contains high concentrations of mercury, and they're giving two doses of the flu vaccine to infants. Okay, I believe it's at 6 months, and then again a second dose at 7 or 8 months of age. This is a problem. But more so than that, right now there are very high concentrations of aluminum, and aluminum is a well-known, well-documented, scientifically documented neurotoxin. What does that mean? It means it can cause damage to the neurological system. Also, it can cause immunological problems. And I document several of these studies in my vaccine books. For example, I've got a study right in front of me now that I wanted to talk about. The exposure to aluminum in vaccines can cause autoimmune and neurological damage. And this study just came out this year, and it was by a Canadian doctor, Chris Shaw, up in Canada, and a woman by the name of her last name is Tom Lejenovic. They put together this study called Aluminum in the Central Nervous System, Toxicity in Humans and Animals, Vaccine Adjuvants, and Autoimmunity. A lot of people ask me, why is aluminum put into vaccines? Well, the short answer is that it actually saves a little bit of money to the vaccine manufacturer. The longer answer is that it's an immune stimulant. Actually, it's an immune irritant. What happens is that they put it into the vaccine because your body rejects it. Your body fights it, and as a result of the aluminum, it actually causes an increase in antibody production. So it stimulates the body to produce more antibodies than it normally would if the aluminum was not placed in the vaccine. But a problem with this is that sometimes it can overstimulate the immune system, and then it causes autoimmune malfunctions. Another problem is that it can seep into the brain and into the nervous system, and then you've got neurological problems. So this is a big, serious issue.
We're gonna break here and come back, and Neil can pick up right where he left off in a minute or two. This is Daniel Cobb, Doctor of Oriental Medicine, in the studio with Neil Miller, where we're talking about vaccinations and the call-in number. We'd love to have call-in questions. 505-424-4550. So now, Neil, why don't you pick up about where you left off?
Well, I was talking about aluminum. I just want to let people know a few of the names of these studies. In the July 2013 issue of Immunologic Research, very important study on the dangers of aluminum in vaccines. In the 2011 issue of Current Medicinal Chemistry, another very important study showing that aluminum vaccine adjuvants are unsafe. In the November 2011 issue of the Journal of Inorganic Biochemistry, there was another important study showing that vaccines adjuvants, aluminum in vaccines, are dangerous. In Lupus Magazine last year, 2012, there was an important vaccine study called Mechanisms of Aluminum Adjuvant Toxicity and Autoimmunity in Pediatric Populations. This is an important study. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the science is there. I'm not just making this information up. These are not my opinions. The information in my books are not my opinions. This is all information where these vaccine studies are being summarized. And you can go and actually read these studies, and you can find out exactly what's being caused here. In the 2012 issue of Lupus, there was a study called Macrophagic Myofasciitis Characterization and Pathophysiology, where they're talking about aluminum having been scientifically linked to chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis-like demyelinating disorders, and cognitive dysfunction. In clinical reviews in Allergy and Immunology, the October 2011 issue, Macrophagic Myofasciitis, a vaccine, autoimmune-related disease. These are studies that are actually published in peer-reviewed journals. So when you talk to your doctor and your doctor says that vaccines are absolutely 100% safe, or that the adverse reaction is a very extreme, rare event, and that vaccines are effective, I'm here to tell you that that's not true. I'm here to tell you that there's plenty of evidence documenting this scientific safety and efficacy deficits. And it behooves you as a parent or as an individual that may be required or may be investigating whether or not to get vaccines for yourself or your family, you have an obligation to investigate this information and make an informed decision.
Neil, going back to the idea of aluminum, I'm thinking that a lot of people are just a little skeptical about how dangerous aluminum can be. For instance, a lot of people cook in aluminum pots. They have aluminum utensils. They drink sodas out of aluminum cans and beer out of aluminum cans. And I'm thinking, I'm exposed to aluminum all the time, you know, aluminum foil on my food. But how dangerous can, you know, injected aluminum be? And I remember, I can't quote it directly from a David Ayoub presentation that I saw, is that there's a significant difference in the toxicity of injected aluminum from aluminum that you might get through absorption through your skin or from food.
Absolutely. Aluminum that's injected is bypassing, for example, the gastrointestinal tract. And there's, again, many studies that are showing that this is this has neurotoxic effects. Another thing that is very important to keep in mind, for example, when children are vaccinated or infants are vaccinated at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, these children are getting hepatitis B vaccine, they're getting polio vaccine, they're getting diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, they're getting vaccines for pneumococcal, rotavirus, HIB, Haemophilus influenza type B. All these vaccines contain numerous chemical substances, and I speak about this in my lectures often. Aluminum is just one of the ingredients that's found in these vaccines. You'll find formaldehyde is found in these vaccines. There's about 12 or 15 different just classifications of different types of chemical substances that can be found in vaccines. So you've got not just the combined aluminum. When you've got these eight different vaccines that a child's getting at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, three or four of these vaccines actually contain high concentrations of aluminum. So you're getting an overdose of aluminum, and then you're also getting many of these other different chemical substances. So you've got this combination toxic synergy that's taking place. In my book, Vaccine Safety Manual, Dr. Russell Blaylock did the foreword to that book. Dr. Russell Blaylock is one of the world's foremost authorities on neurotoxicity. He's a brain surgeon. He's one of the top brain surgeons in the country. He's retired now. But he understands what exactly happens when a child receives a vaccine. And he talks about the actual specific immune system. There, not just the immune system of the body, but Dr. Blaylock talks about a specialized immune system of the brain itself. And Dr. Blaylock, who does brain surgery, has actually seen inside the brains of young children after they've been vaccinated. And he sees the actual damage that the vaccines do to the brain. And he discusses this, and he discusses this process that he calls as priming the system. For example, right now, the CDC is recommending that pregnant women get vaccinated. They're recommending that pregnant women be vaccinated with a flu vaccine, and the flu vaccines contain high concentrations of mercury. Now, they've got no studies to document the safety of vaccinating pregnant women with mercury-laced flu vaccines, and yet they're making this recommendation. It's not based on science. It's not evidence-based. It's just based on this idea that they want to vaccinate these pregnant women, and they have this idea that somehow they're going to protect these fetuses. And yet, if you go up to the website of the Environmental Protection Agency, and you look up the mercury concentrations and the find out what the levels of mercury toxicity are, you'll find that the recommendations that the CDC is making to vaccinate pregnant women and then to give these infants mercury-laced flu vaccines again at 6 months and again at 8 months of age, you'll find that you're going over the actual safety levels that the Environmental Protection Agency talks about for fetuses and for young infants. So this is a very serious problem. I talk about this in my studies, where the CDC actually does not base their childhood immunization schedule recommendations. When they recommend how many vaccines and at what ages children should receive these vaccines, this is not based on science. There's actually no science to prove the safety or even the efficacy of giving eight vaccines to infants at 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months of age. It's based on convenience. It's convenient.
So, Neil, so to break that down, they study, when they're doing the safety studies or the efficacy studies, they're looking at one vaccine
That's
at a
right.
time.
That's
one,
right.
only
and,
one.
And not only are they looking at one vaccine at a time, but they play these little tricks. These are ploys that are conducted by the pharmaceutical companies and that are allowed and permitted by the FDA, even sometimes against the FDA's own written guidelines for how studies, clinical trials have to be conducted. For example, one of the tricks that they use is to omit children that have health problems or health issues, okay, or infants that are below a certain weight. So, for example, when they do the study, they'll give the vaccine to children that are healthy, children that have a certain weight. But then, when the vaccine is recommended, and now all the children throughout the nation are being given this vaccine, they're giving it to children that are below weight, so they're getting higher concentrations per body weight of these chemical substances. They'll give it to groups that were not included in the actual clinical trials. Another ploy or another trick that's used by the pharmaceutical companies is to not use a true placebo, so that when they test these vaccines for safety, for example, they'll test, let's say, 10,000 children will get the vaccine and 10,000 children will get a so-called placebo. The problem is that they're giving children with the so-called placebo aluminum injections. So they're getting actual aluminum injections as a placebo. This is not a harmless substance, and that's what you're supposed to have. You're supposed to have an inert substance that won't, you know, like a sugar pill, so that you can do a true comparison between the product that you're testing and another control group that's not getting that product. This is not conducted that way.
Another thing that I saw along the same vein is how loose the regulation gets in the FDA is when they get a new vaccine. Sometimes, you know, the theory is you're supposed to test it against people that don't get the vaccine. But sometimes they'll say, well, we know that this other vaccine is safe and effective, you know, probably through some, you know, slippery, you know, safety testing for that vaccine. But they make the claim, we know this other vaccine is safe, so we'll compare our vaccine to the other vaccine.
Yes, exactly. They did that with swine flu, for example. They said that we know that flu vaccines are safe, which they're not, by the way. I've got the evidence. I've got the documentation. But they pushed through swine flu vaccine on that basis, where they said, we know that the other flu vaccines have a good safety record, so we're not going to require stringent studies on the swine flu vaccine.
Yeah, we'll just see if the swine flu vaccine does just as well as the other ones, then it's okay. We're going to go to a break now, and I want to give the call-in number, 505-424-4550, and we love those call-in questions, and especially this week because Neil's with us. This is Daniel Cobb, Doctor of Oriental Medicine. I'm here in the studio with Neil Miller, one of the three or four most knowledgeable people about vaccines in the entire country. I'm thrilled to have him on. The call-in number, if you want to call in and ask me or Neil a question, 505-424-4550. Neil, got a question. Going back to when I was young and getting vaccines, didn't get as many back in the late 1950s, early 1960s, but we did get them. But the idea that was presented to me was that I was going to be exposed to a weakened version of this pathogen, and I wouldn't get the disease from the vaccine, but that my immune system would identify it and generate antibodies against the disease, and this would make me immune, and that my immunity would last a lifetime. Now, can you pick that logic apart?
Well, there's a theory and there's reality. In fact, one of my earlier books was called that exactly. It was called Immunization Theory versus Reality. And the theory is that if you give a small amount of the disease germ to an individual, you can stimulate the immune system. If you give just enough of it so that it doesn't cause the disease, but a small enough amount so that it stimulates the immune system, you can protect people. And that's the idea. And there's maybe some good arguments that people can make, that you can look back and you can say there were high amounts of disease before we had some of these vaccines, and there's low amounts of some of these diseases after we had these vaccines. But you have to also look at the counter argument. For example, that polio vaccine, I've got 62 different documented studies from around the world showing that the polio vaccine has been linked to various types of brain cancers, bone cancers, lung cancers, and leukemia. That the polio vaccine was contaminated with SV40, which is a simian virus.
And just to be clear, The officials that were promoting this vaccine knew about the contamination. They knew that it caused cancer, and they knew that it would cause that even in the beginning, before they'd vaccinated anybody, they knew that it would probably cause human cancers. And within a year or two, they even found a mechanism for it causing cancer. But yet their response was?
Their response was to fire the people that actually discovered the link between the polio vaccine and these cancer-causing agents. So, you know, Dr. Blalock, who, like I had mentioned a little bit earlier, who did the forward to my book, Vaccine Safety Manual, he actually says that the industry, the medical doctors and the CDC, the FDA, the World Health Organization, they are more interested in protecting the vaccine program at all costs. The vaccine program must be protected at all costs, even if those costs are, you know, deaths and damage to our precious babies. So this is a serious problem.
And just to be clear, even if the bad aspects of the vaccine program are worse than the good aspects.
The thing that I am here for today,
right,
and the reason that I speak out so much around the country to wake parents up, is so that they can make their decisions in an informed way. If you get your information from the medical industry, you're not getting informed information. You're only getting one side. You're only getting this idea that vaccines are safe, vaccines are effective, shut up and go get your vaccines, okay? And I'm here to tell you that the scientific evidence shows that there are many safety issues, there are many efficacy issues. Many of these vaccines aren't as effective as they're put out to be. Parents have a right and parents have an obligation to investigate vaccines, and you must be free to accept or reject vaccines. We're talking now about human rights abuses. When the medical industry hides the actual true amount of destruction and damage that's related to these vaccines and doesn't give us a fair, informed perspective on what actually is occurring or what actually are the odds or the safety and or the benefits and risks of vaccines. When we get a skewed perspective on the safety and risks of vaccines, these are human rights abuses. Parents aren't able to make informed decisions. And this is a very important point. When you go back to the 1950s and 1960s, and you know that these we know that these vaccines were contaminated and they should have been pulled off the market. And instead of being pulled off the market, instead of parents being made aware, instead of everybody being told that this is what was occurring, instead they took the opposite position and said, let's continue the vaccine program as though this doesn't really occur, as though this isn't really affecting and damaging people. You're talking about human rights abuses. 100 million people in the United States and around the world received these contaminated polio vaccines. These vaccines contained cancer-causing viruses. They increased by more than 20% the incidence of these brain cancers, bone cancers, lung cancers, and leukemias. Also, SV40 in the studies is shown to be sexually transmissible, just like AIDS. This means that not just those people that received those vaccines in the 50s and 60s are at risk of these cancer-causing viruses. Everybody that received them, and then when they had sex with their partners, those people had the risk of having it passed on to them. And mothers have the risk of passing it on to their babies, years later. So this is now circulating. This SV40 has been circulating for many years. And this is just one example. This is just one example when we're going back to look at the link between polio vaccines And the point I wanted to make here was that the equation is much larger than just saying there were lots of cases of polio before the polio vaccine came out, and now there's less cases of polio. Because I can make the opposite argument: there were few cases of cancer before the polio vaccine came out, and now there are huge numbers of cancer after that polio vaccine came out, and there's scientific documentation to show a link between that. I can also go and talk about many different studies, for example, that document the link between vaccines, and we currently have epidemics of type 1 diabetes. The epidemics of type 1 diabetes in this nation and around the world have been directly linked scientifically in peer-reviewed studies to vaccines. For example, I have a study right here. It was published in the July 2002 issue of Autoimmunity. It's called Clustering of Cases of Insulin-Dependent Diabetes Occurring 3 Years After Haemophilus Influenza B Immunization Support Causal Relationship Between Immunization and IDDM. That's Insulin-Dependent Diabetes Mellitus. Okay? The researchers in this study, they studied hundreds of thousands of children. They broke them up into three different groups. 100,000 of the children received one dose of the Hib vaccine. 100,000 children received four doses of the Hib vaccine, and another group of children received no doses of the Hib vaccine. The researchers waited 7 years, and then they waited 10 years, and they went back to these three different groups, and they analyzed and calculated how many cases of diabetes are in these children now. And they found a 26% increase in cases of diabetes in the group that received four doses of the Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine when compared to the children that received no doses of the Hib vaccine. Okay? And if you calculate out the costs to society, you're talking anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 additional cases of type 1 diabetes just here in the United States at hundreds of thousands of dollars per case, or even millions of dollars. You're talking multi-millions, if not billions of dollars, of additional cost. So this vaccine is not only dangerous, but it's cost-effective. Another important point that you can take from this information that I just gave you is that vaccines, we're not always talking about adverse reactions that are immediate. So you don't always know how long it takes for these effects. In this study and in several subsequent studies, they found that it takes 2 to 4 years for the diabetes to manifest after receiving that vaccine. So you get that vaccine, you think you're protected against a certain disease, while it's insidiously damaging your body, so that 2 to 4 years later, you have a higher opportunity, a higher risk of actually developing type 1 diabetes.
And Neil, this strikes me as insane, because what we're saying was we're trading the possibility for reducing a disease that may last 3 to 7 days, and we're introducing the possibility, the 26% increase in the chance that we may have a disease that will, once it hits, will be with us every day for the rest of our lives.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we're doing with vaccines. We're trading diseases. So who has this right to mandate? Who has this right? Who can play God? Can doctors play God and tell us that we have no choice in this matter of whether or not to vaccinate to protect against one disease, but to increase the risks of developing 1, 2, 3, or 4 other diseases? I've only talked about a few diseases today. I've only talked about aluminum causing neurological and immunological damage. I've only talked about the certain of these vaccines that can cause increases in type 1 diabetes. But like I said, I've got study after study after study, hundreds. I've got thousands of studies that are published in peer-reviewed journals documenting the scientific documentation documenting these risks of vaccination.
I want to shift gears a little bit here and direct our attention toward a vaccine called Gardasil. And Gardasil is the target disease is human papillomavirus, which is suspected of being related to cervical cancer in women. And what we're going to do is we're going to break now, and we're going to come back in a few minutes. The call-in number, in case you want to call in, is 505-424-4550, and we'd love to have you call in today. This is Daniel Cobb, Dr. of Oriental Medicine. I'm here in the studio with Neil Miller. We're talking about vaccines. And if you missed the first three segments, Neil Miller is one of the most knowledgeable people about vaccines in the entire country. If you want to call in with a question for Neil, 505-424-4550, and we'd love to have those questions. Neil.
Yeah, you wanted to mention about immunity not being long-term when you get vaccines, and I do want to point that out, that this is extremely well documented, that when you catch a disease like measles, usually that's for lifetime, you're protected against another case of measles. But with vaccines, the very reason that they continue to give booster doses is because that vaccine does not give you long-term immunity. With several of these vaccines, you'll be protected for maybe a few months to a few years and will need a booster dose. For example, with the pertussis vaccine for children, they're giving these vaccines at 2, 4, and 6 months, and then you get, you know, 3 or 4 additional booster doses, and now they're finding the vaccine is extremely ineffective, and they're giving they're trying to give this vaccine to adolescents and adults to try to create some sort of a, what they call a herd immunity. But you can't create herd immunity with a vaccine that is ineffective. A vaccine that only has a 50% or 60% efficacy rate, you can vaccinate the entire population and you won't be able to develop this so-called herd immunity. That's just a myth. You can only get full protection from contracting a disease naturally. I'm sorry we won't have more time to discuss this issue because I do show several studies that show that some of these diseases are very important to actually contract as children because they prime the immune system in a positive way. They actually develop the immune system, stimulate the immune system, and can protect you from diseases in later life. For example, I document several studies that show that women who have contracted mumps as children actually are less likely to develop ovarian cancer as adults. So here's just one example of where catching a disease as a child actually has a very real valuable function in protecting you from later disease. Well, you wanted to mention also about HPV. You were telling me between the break, Daniel, that you actually had a client that came in and that had some damage from the HPV vaccine.
Yeah, it was the Gardasil vaccine. Now, the thing about vaccine damage, vaccine injury, is that you can't trace it back. It's like a money transfer or an IP address. You look at the person, you look at their symptoms, you look at the chronology, and you say, this is what I think happened. Okay? Now, in this particular case, the person that was this woman, and I don't have her permission to use her name, so I'll just, her first initial is S. I'll call her S. And she was not able to walk. She was able to sort of shuffle her feet a little bit. It took 20 minutes to get back to the treatment room. And then she was, because her muscles around her mouth didn't work very well, it was very difficult for her to explain her circumstances. The first person she saw actually in our clinic ran a biofeedback machine. And the biofeedback machine on its own came up after doing the initial checking of the person, and the biofeedback machine popped up with a statement, this looks like vaccine injury. Okay, so we weren't ready to diagnose at that point, but we got a strong clue from this machine.
The HPV vaccine right now is receiving more reports of damage than almost all the other vaccines combined. A lot of people don't realize that the government actually maintains a secret database of people that have reported vaccine damage. In fact, also, a lot of people don't realize that the government is fully aware that vaccines can damage and kill your baby, because in the late 1980s, they actually developed a taxation system so that when you go to the doctor and buy a vaccine, a portion of the money actually goes into a special congressional fund, sort of like a tax on each vaccine that goes into a fund so that when parents have a child that is damaged or killed from vaccines, that child can be compensated. In the last few years, more than $2.5 billion, that's with a capital B, more than $2.5 billion has already been paid out to parents whose children have been damaged and killed from vaccines.
Well, let's keep in mind that figure is the result of many obvious creditable cases being rejected.
Oh, absolutely. There's numerous cases that are rejected for a lot of frivolous reasons. We're not going to have time to talk about that today, but since we're talking about HPV, I wanted to talk just briefly about this database that the government keeps. Okay, every year, between 25,000 and 30,000 reports are made to this database, okay, documenting that damage that took place in people that received vaccines. So they got a vaccine, you got a healthy individual, they received the vaccine, and now they've got a very serious adverse reaction, a very serious condition, or they've actually died after receiving that vaccine. 25,000 to 30,000 annually, okay? And I tell people, you know, a lot of times you'll see something. I remember just a year or two ago, there was some aspirin that, you know, had a bad smell in it when the people opened the cap. There were like six cases of this, where, you know, around the nation, and the FDA immediately recalled all the aspirin. And yet you've got 25,000 to 30,000 reports of adverse reactions every year, and these vaccines just do not get recalled. But the point I was making is that the HPV vaccine, more reports are made on this vaccine than almost all the other vaccines combined right now. This vaccine was approved by the FDA in June of 2006. And in just the past 6 or 7 years, we're talking we've got over 140 cases where young teenage girls have actually died after receiving the HPV vaccine.
And we're talking about soon thereafter.
Oh, yeah. And we're talking healthy young ladies. We're talking 14, 15, 16-year-old teenage girls in the prime of their life. We're talking soccer stars. We're talking athletic. We're talking
very intelligent.
Intelligent young ladies. Just die. And we're also talking many of them having all of a sudden having heart problems. This vaccine's been linked to heart problems, cardiovascular issues. I've got several studies here. For example, here's a study that came out in the Annals of Medicine, okay? And this came out in March of 2013. This is a study by a woman, Dr. Tom Lejenovic and Dr. Chris Shaw. Human papillomavirus, HPV vaccine policy, and evidence-based medicine, are they at odds? This study shows that clinical trials show absolutely no evidence that HPV vaccination can protect against cervical cancer. So here's evidence, a scientific peer-reviewed study showing that there's actually no evidence that this vaccine actually can even protect against cervical cancer.
Well, Neil, in fact, it's not even possible that there could be evidence, because cancer takes a long time to develop. And the safety study for these things lasted, for Gardasil, what I understand is that it lasted 17 months.
Exactly. Here's another study that was published in the American Journal of Reproductive Immunology. This study just was published just a couple of months ago in July of 2013. Okay. This study was titled Human Papillomavirus Vaccine and Primary Ovarian Failure, Another Facet of the Autoimmune Inflammatory Syndrome Induced by Adjuvants. That's a fancy way of saying that the aluminum in the HPV vaccine is causing a new disease, premature ovarian cancer. So the HPV vaccine is causing autoimmunity and premature ovarian cancer. So a vaccine that's actually been developed to protect against cervical cancer has actually been proven in a scientific peer-reviewed study to cause ovarian cancer.
And another point of background about the HPV vaccine is ovarian cancer is one of the milder cancers. It's easy to detect and it's easy to treat in its early stages.
Absolutely.
So it's not much of a threat these women.
In fact, Pap tests, Pap smears, is the best way to protect against this. In fact, they know this. They've gone, you know, the places, the country, you know, cervical cancer is not that prevalent in the United States or in industrialized nations. It's most prevalent in third world nations, and it's most prevalent in third world nations where they have not instituted Pap tests. And if you anywhere that we go into nations to develop Pap tests, we can protect against this disease. In fact, they know. In fact, I've got several studies that document that there's no evidence that the HPV vaccine can actually protect any greater than what a Pap test can accomplish. Mm-hmm. And for more information about this, I've got, again, lots of free information up on my website at thinktwice.com, thinktwice.com. Lots of free information up there.
And a pretty good response. I mean, if you throw questions their way or my way, you're going to get an aggressive response. You know, we're not defending against questions. We're welcoming them. And I'm going to guess that you get tons of emails on a routine basis.
I get emails every day from parents that had perfectly healthy children and went to get these vaccines because the doctor told them they had to, or because the doctor mm-hmm. told them they were safe and effective. And they contact me now and say, My child is damaged. My child is hurt. What can I
right.
do?
And to the greatest extent possible, do you actually try to respond to most of those?
I respond to every one of my emails.
Every one. That's amazing, Neil. Okay.
I try to help parents, but I wish I could reach the parents before the damage was done.
Yeah. Okay, and there you have it. I was thrilled to have Neil Miller on the show today. One of the most knowledgeable people on vaccines in the whole country. This is Daniel Cobb, Doctor of Oriental Medicine, and that's my show for this week.